pleased and privileged to have sitting with us this morning. And of course, we welcome his help, Judge Ruben Castillo, an experienced and distinguished judge of the Northern District of Illinois. So we please these.
Thank you, Judge Plum.
Our first case for argument this morning is Patriotic Veterans versus the State of Indiana. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Every appellate court to consider state laws prohibiting robocalls has concluded that, number one, they're not preempted by federal law, and number two, that they are perfectly valid under the First Amendment. Our position is this court shouldn't go out of its way to create any kind of circuit conflict or conflict with lower with state Supreme Courts, because this is an area where there's been, in many ways, a remarkable uniformity, at least at that level.
Well, we just have the Eighth Circuit at this point, right? The Ninth hasn't ruled.
Right. The Ninth had federal auto dialer laws in front of it.
Exactly.
Its First Amendment cases were, we think they're instructive. They were commercial speech, not political speech. We still think that would disagreement with those cases would present a tension, but there's not as clear a conflict as with Van Bergen in the Eighth Circuit. Now, with regard to, let me just start with preemption, since that's where the district court ruled against us. The difficulty with finding preemption is that when you peel back the layers and you keep looking, there's just nothing there. The TCPA has this rolling narrative about it that assumes a level of preemption growing out of the Communications Act of 1934. But the TCPA itself never preempts states on anything, and in fact has a savings clause that we've discussed extensively. The 34 Act, on the other hand, speaks only in terms of regulating and granting the federal authorities the ability to regulate communications, services, and facilities, and also common carriers.
Yeah, but tell me this.
Mm-hmm.
What rationale would Congress have for not allowing the Act to preempt laws that prohibit the interstate use of auto dialers, but allowing it to preempt those state laws that impose restrictive regulation of interstate auto dialers?
Yeah, I think I understand your question, and I think the best I've been able to deduce from that is, there are sets of regulations concerning hours that calls can be made, concerning, for example, the disclosures that have to be made on a particular call. Those may be the kinds of regulations Congress had in mind and wanted to perhaps was more, I don't know what they were thinking exactly, but perhaps they thought that would be more difficult, except, a prohibition would be something easier to find state by state. It's not a great explanation. But the point is, there isn't even any preemption language to say that they actually wanted to preempt on the regulatory side either.
But that question leads to the very ambiguity that Judge Lawrence found.
Uh-huh.
Does it not? That is the savings clause ambiguity.
Sure, it does. But mm-hmm. let's bear in mind, this is not an area of law where ambiguity goes against the state.
Mm-hmm.
We have a presumption against preemption. And we have a reasonable reading of the savings clause. Certainly the FCC acknowledged that. They didn't say we were necessarily right, but they acknowledged that it was a reasonable understanding.
So then Judge Lawrence relied on legislative history, and in
right.
particular, what was it, a statement by Senator Hollins?
Senator Hollins, the sponsor of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the court needs to be aware, there was a decision earlier this week from the U.S. Supreme Court.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Doesn't Judge Ginsburg talk about Senator Hollins again?
She does, and she says even the sponsor of the bill is not entitled to deference about his statement, that she's mm-hmm. going to look behind that and see whether it's right. And
well, legislative history is in no way controlling, is it?
No, it's not. You have to look at the actual text of things. I mean, Congress can make all the findings at once, but, if it declares a statute constitutional, I don't think this court would say, oh, well, Congress found that to be the case, so therefore, we're going to defer to that. So you actually have to look back, you have to peel back the layers, look at what's going on back in the 34 Act. It's not an act that has to do with telemarketing or harassment. It's an act that has to do with infrastructure. Now, there's an interesting side point to that, which is the 34 Act expressly disclaims preemption for intrastate calls. We know that. But it's not for all intrastate calls. It's only where a state commission is going to regulate the intrastate call. That's not a, you know, with all respect to my boss, that's not a state attorney general they're talking about. That is a state, you know, utility regulatory commission. And if that body does not regulate the communications by wire intrastate, then it goes back to the FCC. So there's just no way they were talking about this kind of use of the telephone.
So you see Judge Ginsburg's MIMS opinion helping you, her analysis?
Ultimately, you know, certainly the I would be lying if I said I didn't, you know, wasn't disappointed that she went through some of that historical narrative, but I think what we have to bear in mind is she was using the historical narrative as merely as backdrop to where she was going, which is why would Congress have permitted federal courts to retain jurisdiction. It's relevant for that discussion. There's no point in looking behind the history for her purposes in that case, but I don't think it's a definitive statement that, therefore, the 34 Act is preemptive.
You know, we're not in the business of rewriting state laws, although some of them think we are. But it seems that there are quite a few more narrowly tailored ways to protect residential privacy without abolishing, you know, an entire genre of speech. For example, Indiana already has a do not call list for commercial calls. Mm-hmm. Why not have one for political calls, allowing Indiana citizens to opt out of receiving auto-dial calls? And if the state wanted to be even more protective, I guess it could establish an opt-in method whereby only those people who have affirmatively consented by submitting their names to a statewide registry could be called, or perhaps the state could, I don't know, require auto-dialers to say at the outset, at the very outset of a call, this is so-and-so calling. If you wish to be removed from our calling list, press 1 now or bang the phone down. or if you agree to hear a recorded message from our CEO, press 1 now. Does the fact that myriad options exist say anything about the narrow tailoring of for the statute?
And I think you put your finger on the crux of that First Amendment issue really is. And what we have to bear in mind is that when we're talking about content-neutral, time, place, and manner laws, it's not least restrictive means. It's reasonable fit. And, you know, Hill v. Colorado is a classic example of basically a consumer opt-out law. You can't talk to somebody unless they at first tell you you can. So we know that model fits in some circumstances. It's also important to just step back and bear in mind the chronology here. Auto-dialer law came first, then do-not-call law. So you're starting back in 1988. I think, not a whole lot of experience with this regulatory field. You've got auto-dialers seeming to be the most nefarious mode of telemarketing. Let's start off with a broad restriction. Let people decide if they want to opt out of the protection scheme that they can. Okay, fast forward then 12 years or so. We're still not getting the protection we want. There's a concern that we need to give those who want to opt in more protection, but also, and I think this court validly pointed this out in National Coalition, not necessarily sweeping in the political calls. You know, there is a special First Amendment sensitivity there, and that is something that restricts states from targeting political speech, but it also justifies when states don't necessarily treat political speech the same as the commercial speech. And so there was a less restrictive regulatory scheme then left to be applied to the political calls than to the sales calls and even to the charitable solicitations.
Mr. Fisher, is it your position that all the state has done is, as the commercial speech, not prohibited speech, just made it more costly? Because isn't that the bottom line here, where under the scheme, to get the speech in, you have to have the live communicator.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me make sure I'm clear on your question. You said commercial speech.
Well, the speech that you're attempting, I don't want to get into the exemptions, or, you know, for charity.
You start, okay, you're talking about the out of Iowa law. Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Telemarketing.
Yeah. Precisely. So it's not that you can't make the calls. I think that's a very important observation. You have to use a live operator. Now, you know, that is, I think people can debate whether, you know, after the telephone rings and you've been disrupted, you've been harassed, that you pick it up, and whether it's a live operator or a recording. Probably different people have different views about whether that which is preferable. But the point is that the person-to-person contact is something that is still permitted, which is in many ways analogous to the door-to-door solicitation. But this automated business where you have such a low-cost method of calling people that you as the caller, as the one who is disrupting people, don't even feel that impact. You don't have any disincentive to make the calls in a way. This law helps to re-internalize those costs. It helps to make it a fairer system in terms of self-regulation, in terms of self-limitation, so that the costs are borne a little bit more equally at the very least, but still permitting the communication to happen if it's really worth it. So I think that is an important distinction to draw here.
I take it your position or the state's position that if we agree with you on preemption, there's no need to send this case back to the district court. That we can just, on the state of the record, decide the First Amendment question.
I agree completely with that. I think that there aren't any disputed material facts. Any review of the district court on the First Amendment would be de novo anyway, so we're perfectly comfortable with this court resolving on First Amendment grounds. No further questions. I'll just reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Fisher. You. Mr. Jefferson.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. I'm Paul Jefferson. I'm privileged to be here today on behalf of Patriotic Veterans. Judge Flom, I'd like to begin with a question you asked, because I think what the Indiana statute does, it is actually imposes less costs on commercial speech in Indiana and imposes more costs on political speech. If you look at the exemptions and the justification for the Indiana statute, the Indiana justification is to prohibit widespread political communication. If you look at the exemptions on the auto dialer statute, which allow for speech by commercial callers unlimited to subject on the basis of the statute, it actually makes it less expensive to engage in commercial speech than political speech. And that's one of the fundamental flaws. This isn't permissible either under the TCPA, either because it is an interstate regulation or because it's a prohibition. Under the TCPA, under the plain language of the statute, the preemption, the savings clause means that the statute has to preempt something. I'm not sure what is left to preempt if the state's reading of the savings clause were to apply, but either it preempts interstate communications, which is what Patriotic Veterans engages in, or it preempts, it allows states to only prohibit. The Indiana auto dialer statute, as the district court properly held, is a regulation, not a prohibition. In addition, sticking to the First Amendment arguments, or to the preemption arguments.
Could I just...
Yes, please.
...come into... you stated in your brief that, quote, nothing in the TCPA in any way suggests that this savings clause is designed to provide authority to the state to regulate interstate calls. To me, that statement is a bit hyperbolic. I mean, truly, is there really nothing? There is at least arguably this very plain language
Your Honor,
in reading the statute, which says that states can prohibit auto-dialing calls. Isn't that at least some suggestion?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. When I said regulate, I meant the distinction between regulation versus prohibition.
But I'd appreciate, you know, your answering
sure.
My question.
As it relates, taken out of the equation, whether we're talking about interstate or intrastate calls, the TCPA allows states to prohibit certain things. And a prohibition, and that I think makes sense, Your Honor, because then you're in a situation where either a state is going to allow something, whether it's on an intrastate or interstate basis, or it isn't, which for companies like Patriotic Veterans, who are trying to do disseminate political speech in an economical way, to inform voters in an economical way, that makes sense. It allows them to either know this is it's either allowed or it isn't. Not you have to have a live operator with certain types of consent requirements, or there's specific relationships that could come into play, those types of regulations. So I think what Congress was trying to do, as it relates to the prohibit versus regulate, is simply make it easier for callers to know what they were allowed to do or not do.
You know, I was really very interested in the district court's rationale, you know, particularly when the district court noted that it would compel a strange result if the savings clause protects a state's ability to prohibit interstate calls, but not its ability to place restrictions on it. Because I don't think it's such a strange result at all. Perhaps Congress didn't want states wandering into a potential content-based censorship morass, or creating murky laws that are hard for national marketers to follow. I mean, a bright line rule is easy to follow. For example, no calls allowed in Indiana, Ohio, and Colorado. It's much harder for companies to follow, you know, a patchwork of regulations such as no calls to Indiana unless preceded by an opt-in choice, or no calls to Ohio between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Wouldn't that logic get rid of the district court thought was some sort of a strange result?
I agree that Congress was trying to make things simpler, and I think that in terms of, as it relates to political speech, that's even more important. I mean, we've got a great example in the news today. If someone wants to comment on what's going on in the South Carolina primary based on news events that developed yesterday, there are not many ways to do that. To do it in a way that you know you can reach people, you know that the message is disseminated, to do it in the speaker's own voice. And so if when you're dealing with timeliness issues, it gives you even less ability to go and figure out what the patchwork of various state regulations are or aren't. And so having a situation where either the state is allowed to do something or not allowed to do something within a confined area, whether it be intrastate or interstate, I think furthers Congress's intent in enacting the savings clause.
Can I ask you one more question about the preemption analysis? What about the presumption against preemption? That seems to have been followed by the Eighth Circuit. Is there any mention of that at all by the district court?
I don't recall any mention of it in the order. I believe it's not mentioned in the order. It's certainly our position that the presumption only matters if the statute isn't clear. And what is clear from the statute is Congress meant to preempt something. The question, and the only ambiguity, I guess, to mm-hmm. the extent an ambiguity exists, is what is that? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where the state's analysis leads that Congress is allowed to preempt, but I think there's only two choices under the language of the statute. Mm-hmm. Either it preempts interstate regulation, or it preempts things that do something other than just simply prohibit.
Yeah, well, your position is that if Congress intended to upset the longstanding division of authority between the states and the federal government over interstate calls, it would have done so more clearly. But such a rationale seems to be really counter to the ordinary presumption against preemption.
Well, Your Honor, there is no doubt that when Congress enacted the TCPA, and we can debate based on recent cases and ones that are before whether that was right, but when Congress enacted the Savings Clause in the TCPA, it believed that states did not have jurisdiction over interstate communication. Regardless of whether that belief was accurate or inaccurate, I think the language that finds its way into the statute, which is what the district court and we're trying to apply here, clearly is based on that premise.
Mr. Jefferson, let me approach it a little differently because I'm concerned about total prohibition versus limitation, and that's why I asked Mr. Fisher about it. You would agree that, I'll ask you if you agree, that even as to political speech, which you would involve patriotic veterans with, there's no prohibition on it. It's just more costly, right?
Well, I perhaps. But as it relates to political speech from auto dialers, I come back to the example that's going on in South Carolina. There are times, and this may well be one of those times, when there is no other way to costly, quickly, effectively, and in a way you can track, deliver message. But generally, I agree that they're...
All right. Well, yeah. Let's say Patriotic Veterans also in an intrastate or interstate operation regularly uses a truck with a megaphone. And a residential area in Indiana has a limitation on time. That megaphone can't operate between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. Do we have anything similar to that here, that it's just squeezing either time or means?
Your Honor, we may, if that's all it did. But what's curious about this statute is that this statute would allow debt collectors to walk around your neighborhood with a megaphone. It would allow a school district to walk around a neighborhood with your megaphone. It would allow your employer to walk around a neighborhood with a megaphone to talk to you about your employment hours. But your candidate, who you don't have a sufficient personal relationship with,
well,
the candidate,
a little,
political speaker.
You do, would you not agree, Mr. Jefferson? You have a little different barrier on... on the either physical contact or than you do with the unique communication that comes through the phone into the home.
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, there certainly are differences, and obviously a phone call is not a megaphone. But my point is that
Today with today's apps, maybe that's the next thing.
Well, you know, I tend to think that the technology is friend of the First Amendment. In 1988, there was no such thing as caller ID. The intrusiveness of a phone call today may be very well different. You know, the use of cell phones was very different in 1991 when the TCPA was enacted. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we should ignore that technology when we're analyzing the First Amendment issues. I think we should embrace it. But what is curious about the Indiana statute, again, is in terms of the content, in terms of what the statute allows, it allows... There's certainly a content-based restriction as it relates to employers and employees, but it also allows people who have a business or personal relationship, which amazingly, based on the national prayer case, excludes our political candidates, excludes people who want to deal with political issues, but it allows those commercial speakers and political or personal basis speakers to speak on any subject whatsoever. It allows in Indiana, school districts can do funding issues by referendum. It's quite possible that a school system may want to use a pre-recorded call because it's effective, because it'll reach everyone, to talk to the members of its school district that it wants to on a political issue. But a candidate and Patriotic Veterans can't do that under the statute as it's written and as applied.
Why do you think the district court simply ignored preemption? I mean, he ignored all of the preemption reading doctrines. What? Can you explain it?
I don't know exactly what you're asking, Judge, but in terms of, I think the district court focused on the language of the statute and in our view, correctly determined that it has to have some preemptive effect. And it went through the two ways that it could do that as applied here.
Well, the plain language here expressly saves the regulation at issue from preemption. And if the language weren't clear, you know, we'd have to presume there was no preemption. But where the text of a preemption clause is susceptible of more than reading, courts have a duty to accept the reading that disfavors preemption. I am, you know, I'm befuddled.
I think, Your Honor, that, and we've conceded in our brief, that the language of the savings clause is somewhat awkward. But that doesn't change the intent Congress had to preempt something when they put the savings clause in the statute. Savings clauses don't exist in statutes unless there's some preemptive effect. And so it's important to limit the ambiguity to where it ends. It doesn't end that because the statute's ambiguous, there's no preemptive effect to it. It is certainly
for that, do you have to rely on this statement from Senator Hollins?
Yeah.
That's certainly our view, is that the language of the statute is the first place that you would go. But the statement by Senator Hollings certainly helps buttress that. And
you want to say anything about the Mims case decided this week?
Your Honor, candidly, I reviewed that to see whether it influenced my arguments mm-hmm. enough to bring it before the court, and my quick review didn't see that it changed our analysis mm-hmm. too much. So, candidly, I'll go back and reflect on it, but I mm-hmm. don't have anything today.
You also agree that if we disagree on preemption, there's enough of a record here to make a decision on your First Amendment claim?
I do agree, and I would like to highlight a couple aspects of that record on that mm-hmm. issue. The first is that when the state's own expert was asked whether or not there are citizens in Indiana who want to receive pre-recorded political calls, his word was undoubtedly there are. So at the beginning of the analysis when we're talking about that record, and in fact there are a few affidavits in the record that we've submitted from people both on the Do Not Call list and off the Do Not Call list that support the proposition that pre-recorded political communications would be welcomed by some residents. And so I do agree that addressing the First Amendment argument, assuming that it needs to be addressed, would be appropriate, and we have no problems with this circuit reviewing it. On that issue, Mr. Fisher and I agree.
Suppose the statute prohibited all auto dialer calls unless the recipient had explicitly opted in, perhaps by registering her name on a statewide registry. Would this pass muster under the First Amendment? And for the sake of the hypothetical, let's assume intermediate scrutiny.
I don't think so. Because I don't think it leaves, among other things, adequate alternative means, and I don't think it's sufficiently narrowly tailored. I think that the, you know, in terms of the opt-in issues, I think they're especially problematic under U.S. Supreme Court precedent. I mean, if we look at Meyer versus Grant, that court held that the First Amendment protects in our case, patriotic veterans, quote, right not only to advocate their cause, but also to select what they believe to be the most effective means to do so. I think if we added at the end of that, so long as they've opted in, that would be completely turning the case, that case and similar cases on its ear. I think that it's especially problematic to figure out how an opt-in requirement works. And let's not forget that under the TCPA, there's already a requirement to disclose who's making the call. What is remarkable about the juxtaposition of this statute with the Do Not Call law is that when the state argued the Do Not Call law, they relied on Rowan. And the fulcrum in Rowan was that the Postal Service wasn't making the decisions for the citizens of Indiana, or for the citizens. It was that citizens got to make the decision. And in this instance, they want to take that choice away.
So I take it, though, that your response to my question would be the same if the statute prohibited all auto dialer calls to any number that was signed up on a statewide Do Not Call list. And you think that would pass muster under the First Amendment?
Well, I think that a Do Not Call list is a closer question in terms of whether someone's opted into that versus whether someone's opted out. There are problems with a Do Not Call list, not the least of which is that how do we make sure that the Do Not Call list, if we're dealing with residential phone numbers, is only limited to the people who want to receive the calls. Again, I come back to the view that if these calls are not effective, they won't be used. There's disclosure requirements already in the federal statute regarding knowing who's making the call, allowing citizens to decide. It'd be similar to be able to say, you know, citizens in Indiana don't like attack ads, so we're going to ban them from the TV. And that's not how the First Amendment allows us to operate. There undoubtedly are some citizens in Indiana who don't want to receive these calls, but there undoubtedly are some that do. And the problem under the First Amendment is that Indiana makes that decision for everyone. Your Honor, in conclusion, my point is simply that, at least under the First Amendment analysis, Indiana, I think, seeks to kill a fly with a sledgehammer. In terms of political pre-recorded phone calls, they have an efficiency, a timeliness, an effectiveness, a tracking rate a lack of human error rate that is difficult to duplicate anywhere, if it can be duplicated at all. In fact, Patriotic Veterans does not have the resources and does not place live operator calls in Indiana because of it runs contrary to its mission to limit its exposure that way. The record suggests that proves uncontroverted, it's 8 times more expensive to place a live operator call than it is to place a pre-recorded call. In addition, the state's own expert indicated that pre-recorded calls, what was his word, the norm of politeness. When we're dealing with intrusive effects of calls, the state's own expert agreed that the norm of politeness, and this is also echoed in the affidavit of Patriotic Veterans vendor, that pre-recorded calls are less intrusive than live operator calls. And as someone mentioned earlier, it is possible for the pre-recorded message to ask at the beginning of the call whether someone wants to consent or whether they don't, which is the issue that the Indiana Supreme Court recently addressed in the Free Eats case. So if there's no further questions, we respectfully would ask that this court affirm the district court. And I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Thank you. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor. Listening to Mr. Jefferson's presentation, it sounds like in many ways what Patriotic Veterans really wants to do is to re-argue National Coalition. They're not comfortable with any regulatory scheme that would protect people from unwanted telemarketing calls. I think that basic proposition has been resolved, and the only question is, can we have an opt-out versus an opt-in scheme? And we think that bears a reasonable fit. We think that there is no precedent against it, and Hill v. Colorado collaterally supports the idea. Mr. Jefferson cited Meyer versus Grant for the idea that you're entitled to your form of speech. We have to bear in mind, Meyer versus Grant was a case about political targeting. It was paid petition circulators. That was, you know, a strict scrutiny situation. Cornelius, on the other hand, the court said, in a content-neutral context, you're not entitled to the most efficient means of communication. The megaphone, the car top speaker, those things are all, they may be the most efficient means of communication for anyone. Who knows what the context is. And yet we know from COVAX that can say that that's not an appropriate way to, not allowed way to communicate. The exceptions here do not render the law content-based. They're justified by reference to something other than content, by reference to the self-limitation inherent in the nature of the calls from employers, from schools, to very narrow sectors of their constituents. And even the debt collectors are restricted by federal law from repeated calls. So really there is no preference there to be concerned about. And with regard to the technology, technology means that there are more and more means of communication. You know, the ability to Twitter your message and to have all your followers sign up, I mean, that's something that's become starting to become ingrained in American culture, and more it will. And that's just, you know, further evidence that people know where to go. If they want messages, they know where to go to find it. So we think that there is no real risk here of any...
Mr. Fisher, excuse me. You may finish that thought. Mr. Fisher, looking as we must responsibly at the Eighth Circuit, because that's the other circuit that's spoken to, do you feel the Eighth Circuit sufficiently analyzed the Communications Act of 1934's mandate, whatever? It seemed to go right to the TCPA.
Right.
And understandably so. The reason I mention that is to ask you what your thought is on the sweep of whatever mandate was established in 34.
Right.
And recognizing Lord knows what's happened in the last almost 80 years.
Well, I think that the Eighth Circuit was satisfied with starting and finishing with the TCPA. They didn't feel like there was a need to go any further. That's a perfectly acceptable way to analyze this, given the Savings Clause. But you can't look at the Savings Clause and then immediately assume, therefore, there must be preemption somewhere. You have to find it.
Yeah.
And that if you're going to look for it, that means you have to go back to the 34.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to see what your thoughts were on how much in the Congress wanted in 1934 to totally preempt any state interference in interstate communication.
No. I mean, they were not concerned about harassment. They were trying to get the market going. They wanted to have a regulatory scheme that would facilitate infrastructure and common carriers and to make sure that all of that was going to flourish. And they weren't, at that point, who knew what telemarketing was? There was nothing of the sort that was on the radar screen. So I think that sweep is narrowed to that infrastructure issue.
Yeah, and well, it speaks of national defense and safety and, I mean, there are broad policy concerns.
Oh, sure, yeah.
All keeping, of which, keeping the communication in the event of disasters. And
oh, sure. Like. All of which go to these issues about facilitating the infrastructure so it's ready in a way, you know, the analogous to an interstate highway system, but for you know, information in a way. They want the ability to communicate in that sense, but that doesn't mean
so you like promoting an interstate highway system.
Oh, I, that's probably not a very good comparison. My only point is, as far you mentioned,
I'm asking. I mean, for example, most interstates, I suppose, are still funded substantially by federal funds and a smaller commitment of state funds.
Yeah,
we allow states to have all sorts of regulations on their part of the interstate that
we do, and that gets into spending clause issues and whatnot. And I don't want to get down a rabbit trail here, but the point being, it's about infrastructure, not about content, and not about the harassing uses of the telephone. So I think that's the best way to think about that 34 Act. Nothing further. I'll thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, Mr. Jefferson, and co-counsel. We thank you, and the case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to.